strike. It's really been terrible because they've been put on solitary confinement. And what happens in solitary confinement is that, you know, you get, you know, no, because already you are, you know, on hunger strike, ICE does not want you doing that, right? Because they want you alive, they want you fed, you know, and they're saying, you know, if they're going to get deported, you know, if they're going to, you know, go through all of these, you know, trials and tribulations after they've crossed 8 countries to get here, they want to use their bodies as resistance.
10 seconds on the final call.
We are, you know, so grateful for this platform, Amy. We would love for folks to join us every Friday for Freedom Friday. The men in detention with Laura, with Hurricane Laura in Louisiana, have experienced tremendous, tremendous, you know, outbreaks of not just coronavirus, but other, you know, other forms. For instance, they have no running water right now. They have, their medications are being kept. We have
Sylvie
a young
Bella,
man
we're
who's
have
been
to leave
there for
it there,
2 years.
But I thank you so much, and we'll continue to follow this story, founder of the Cameroon American Council. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, save lives, wear a mask.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. on a Tuesday. It's time for the Abe and, well, we're still calling it Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor, featuring this week the one and only Tracy, I think it's Simmons. Stay tuned.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program on KBOO 90.7 FM. The number to call this morning to take part in the conversation, 503-231-8187. And this is, of course, KBOO Summer Membership Drive, and we'll more about that in just a moment. But this morning, I have a very special guest host to introduce to you. We're very honored to have her with us on the program this morning, Tracy Simmons. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Abe. Hi, listeners. Thanks for the warm welcome.
Absolutely. We're excited to have you here with us today. We've got, as usual these days, a whole bunch of things to talk about. But before we do that, I want to address the elephant in the room, which is the fact that Joe is no longer with the program. I don't want to go into the details of that decision. There will be a recorded message from Joe to his listeners forthcoming sometime in the not-too-distant future. But I want to address that right out of the gate. Joe will no longer be with the program. So, with that, my goodness, Tracy, where to begin?
I don't even know.
What's transpired over the past week has made manifest my worst fear since the Black Lives Matter movement took off this past spring, and that is violence between opposing groups of citizens. And that has now come to pass. It seems now inevitable, but we existed in a limbo for a long time where I thought maybe we would get lucky and this would be an entirely peaceful revolution, as it were. But such things are rare upon the face of this world. How are you feeling in the light of this change in tone?
I'm feeling exhausted and quite sad. You know, part of who I am as a human is not being able to accept, you know, unnecessary death and suffering in the world. And I feel at this point we've reached this new level of terrible, right? Like, I don't even know how to express it except it's really terrible. We've seen, you know, people die at the hands of fellow citizens, and we need someone to really tamp this down, because I just see this becoming exponentially worse over time if there is not a person who intervenes and says, this is it, we've had enough, right? Enough of the violence, enough of harming each other. At what point do we become more convergent to say, these are issues of our society and we have to do something about it, but we are not here to harm each other in that process?
Agreed. That was very well said. I couldn't agree more. Specifically, we are referencing last week in Kenosha, Wisconsin, amid the protests that arose out of yet another unlawful murder of a black man at the hands of police, a young, I can't even call him a white man, he's still a boy, 17 years old, crossed state lines into Wisconsin with a semi-automatic assault weapon and killed two Black Lives Matter protesters and wounded another, and managed to walk right through a line of Kenosha, Wisconsin police carrying his weapon as he did so. I don't think I need to outline for our listeners the stark difference in response between those two individuals, Jacob Blake, who was shot by the police, and this young man, Mr. Rittenhouse, who committed murder. One is dead and one is alive, and the color of their skin will tell you everything you need to know about that story. It's the same old, same old.
Yeah, and just, I mean, right now we have people venerating this young boy as a hero. People saying they would like him to be the president, and I'm going, what? In what world are you living? Like, I mean, the whole thing was illegal. He crossed state lines. His mama brought him across state lines, and we have to start to ask, you know, like, who is popping up this kind of behavior and inciting this behavior? Because they are at some point going to be held, or need to be held, responsible for the way that they use their words and their power to encourage this kind of behavior.
Yeah, it's really kind of astonishing. Although, to your earlier comment, I suppose it's not so big a leap from Donald Trump to an underage white supremacist president, is it? I mean, that leap would have seemed larger, I think, before the modern era. But I should not make light of the situation, because as you mentioned, this is a deadly, deadly serious set of affairs. You're right. It really comes down to, how do people in authority use their power, and against whom is that power directed? And unfortunately, we are seeing the same set of patterns reinforced again and again and again. The difference, I would say, now is that instead of the universal condemnation that this sort of thing rightly ought to elicit from citizens and from the commentariat, we're seeing people like Tucker Carlson on Fox say, well, what did you expect? Well, nobody else would take, would enforce law and order. Is it any surprise that this young man took the law into his own hands? And then we see the President of the United States himself making similar statements. So this creates an incredibly dangerous situation. We are only weeks out from the national election. We are now seeing the first incidences of violence between two sides in a very politicized and polarized electorate. And I don't see this getting better before Election Day rolls around. What do you think?
I think it's serving a purpose, right? It's serving a purpose for the person who wants to be elected, who's currently in the White House, to create division. And it's an old story in the United States. It's not new that, you know, political leadership unfortunately benefits in some way from creating these divisions and stoking these flames of intolerance and racism and othering that is happening. And so we have to really start to begin to wise up ourselves that we are being played, right? We are tools in this kind of system that will continue until we say enough is enough. And so I really want to call on regular folk across that political divide and spectrum to say, who is benefiting from this behavior? Who is benefiting from this suffering and from this division? I know I'm not benefiting in any way. And you know, I am, you know, pretty progressive in my ideas and thoughts about the world, so I don't have the ability to
you know, really engage with people on the right as much as I would like to just understand more about what their experience is, kind of why they have fallen into their line of thinking, and potentially share what my line of thinking is, because I think that's how we're going to become more convergent in really understanding what's happening in the world and understanding how we are playing a part in greater seeds of division and stoking fires of you know, chaos, really.
Do you think the solution is that simple? Is it really just a question of people better understanding the other side's position? It seems to me, in an age when everyone seems entitled to their own set of facts, that that's we may have exhausted that line of inquiry already.
I appreciate that, and I do think there is a big elephant in the room with, you know, people who have a news show but don't call it news and say it's commentary, and really are also fanning these flames, whether we talk about Laura Ingraham or Tucker Carlson, or, you know, even for people who are more right affiliated, Rachel Maddow. You know, I can appreciate how, you know, people are not seeing kind of ever the opportunity to engage in discourse. And then there's the fakeness, right? There's the unsubstantiated ability to just say something and it not be true. And the people, you know, we don't have the, I would say, information literacy skills to determine for ourselves what's true and what's not, whether that is about vaccines, whether that is about, you know, political agendas. Across the spectrum of knowledge, we haven't developed literacy skills to kind of turn off what's not true and lean into what is true. I mean, that's a huge problem. And I think it goes back to the education system and defunding education for many years, anti-intellectualism. I mean, there's so many layers there. But it's a lot harder to kill someone if you know someone who might be thinking like that. If you know someone, if someone in your family has those views, it's a lot easier to kill someone if they have been dehumanized just by calling them a liberal or calling them, you know, a right-wing extremist, a looter, whatever language we use. There's
right.
a dehumanization in that allows us to inflict that kind of harm or see that person as less human or not human at all, right?
Right, or making that determination based on the color of someone's skin. Absolutely. Okay, this is a fascinating conversation. Before we return to it, I need to mention once again that this is the first day of KBOO's summer membership drive. From now until the 20th of this month, we have very generous donors in the community who are willing to match the first $10,000 contributed to the station. I'm going to come out and say, you know, we say something like this every time we have a membership drive, but I believe at this moment in time, it is more important than it has ever been before that we have sources of media like KBOO to elevate the voices of marginalized communities to the forefront of this conversation. Voices that say Black Lives Matter, voices that that criticize the unlawful use of power at the hands of the state, voices that lift up all people in the community so that they become part of the solution to the problems that we're seeing right now. KBOO is part of that solution, and we depend on you to make it work. Pick up the phone, give us a call, or even easier, log on to kboo.fm, click on the donate button, and become a member of KBOO. All the cool kids are doing it. That's all I can say. Now, Tracy, I'm going to follow up on something you just mentioned. You talked about the importance of literacy, political and media literacy in this world, the ability to determine a good piece of reporting from a bad piece of reporting, the ability to distinguish between propaganda and journalism. I would say that ability is largely absent in the populace. And that's not, that is the result of literally decades of disinformation coming from the right and the creation of what has come to be known colloquially as a right-wing echo chamber, in which, as I said earlier, people seem to be entitled to their own set of facts. That makes rational discourse near impossible and leads us to a situation now where we see opposing groups of civilians exchanging gunfire. That was a little bit dramatic, but that essentially sums up the situation. What do we do about that? How do we instill the skills of media literacy into the populace?
I think it requires an education. It requires a pause on part of that media machine that is consistently churning out falsehoods and false narratives and false dichotomies about what's happening in the world, right? As soon as we say Black Lives Matter, a certain group of folks will say socialism, communism, all of these things. And it's like, no, I just made a statement, right? I'm not part of any larger organization. I believe that Black Lives Matter, right? And so I think at some point we've got to, those of us who are willing, really try our best to shut down those forms of media, whether that's InfoWars that no longer has a presence on YouTube, as I've heard, I'm not sure, you know, the Breitbarts of the world. Who are their advertisers? Who are keeping them afloat as far as financially? And how do we use our power of our dollars to say no more? I'm not going to prop up this propaganda machine that is harming our country. Right, we are all being harmed at this point, and we can maybe talk a little bit about, you know, what happened in Portland on Saturday. But yeah, it is, you know, while the narrative around the shooting in Kenosha of the 17-year-old boy towards two other people who were, you know, seen as Black Lives Matter protesters, those were two white men, right? So a young white boy kills two young white men. Here in Portland, it's a white man shooting another white man. It literally, at this point, it's white people being harmed. And we have to think about what's underlying that, right? We know that as a political system, supremacy of white folks can only be maintained if white folks participate. And so I think these powers that want to continue to, you know, express white supremacist views, use their, you know, news platforms to stoke fear and continue this churning out of inequity and inequality, their biggest target and their biggest challenge is if white folks fully reject those ideas. And so now you're seeing not only Black folks being harmed, because we're being harmed and shot in the streets, let me just say that, but you're also seeing white people being harmed and harming each other. I know several people who, you know, have fractures, deep fractures in their families because of this polarization. And so it's harming all of us. And if we can become aware of how it's harming all of us, we might be willing to jump in towards a solution, right? Towards, you know, developing that convergence in a very divergent situation.
In case listeners are unfamiliar with the case in Portland that we're talking about right now, here's what happened. On Saturday, a large caravan of Trump supporters formed in Clackamas County and made their way into downtown Portland. A long train of pickup trucks and Confederate flags, and I'm sure you can picture in your mind exactly what I'm talking about. So this predictably drew the ire of Black Lives Matter protesters, who harangued them peacefully throughout the day. That evening, when the protests continued and the two groups faced off against one another, one member of the right-wing paramilitary group Patriot Prayer was shot and killed by an as-yet-unknown assailant. And that's where we are. I don't want to blame the victim. Nobody at a peaceful protest deserves to die, period. Period. But at the same time, contextually speaking, we would not be where we are were the flames of violence and hatred not being continuously stoked, not only by the occupant of the White House, but by this entire conservative media infrastructure that we've been talking about over the last few minutes. The set of conditions, I feel, has led inevitably to where we are. And it's going to require all of us, I think, to be incredibly vigilant going forward to make sure that this doesn't happen anymore. However, I fear that we're only seeing the beginning. That the violence between opposing groups is only going to escalate between now and Election Day.
Oh, what I would say about that is there are folks who are actually wanting that, right? This is the coming race war that they have been calling for. And I don't know what to do about that. I mean, there are lots of factors I don't know what to do about. But that's one of the main ones, right? If this is something that you see as part of your religious faith, or the rapture is coming, and you know, you've read, you know, the Revelation 50 times backwards and forwards, and you think this is the time, I mean, that level of belief and adherence to that belief is very dangerous and destructive. And I think for those of us who are not really sold on those belief systems, it's like, but these are actual humans. These are your neighbors, whether they live next door or not. I think also in Portland, there is this interesting ethos of wondering where those people came from, where those 600 people on those trucks or 600 trucks in that caravan came from, and saying not from our neighborhood, right? Well, they showed up at the Clackamas Town Center Mall, right? They're from here. Many of them are from here. Whether they have license plates blacked out or not, they're from here. And so these are our neighbors. How do we create connections and really start to dismantle these systems that have caused this deep and lasting separation? I don't know what the answer is, but, you know, in my regular life, I'm consistently looking for those answers and trying to, you know, examine for myself, what is my role? What can I do? So here I am as a guest host on this wonderful talk radio show to see if there's something I can do to influence others and to share thoughts and have a deep, meaningful dialogue about whose responsibility is it. And if we decide for ourselves that our responsibility is in this, what do we do? You know, what do we do with that responsibility?
Spoiler alert, it is everyone's responsibility. let's go to the phones. We've got Karen on the line. Karen, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Karen.
Oh, good morning to you. Good morning to you both, and delighted to hear your guest host. And I just want to amplify a little bit the idea of alternative facts as being distorting of the truth. I've noticed that there's also spin, opinion, interpretation, and other ways of distorting the truth. And for instance, I listened very carefully to Trump say that they're very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville, and how hideous that was. That was an interpretation, right? There and an opinion. And then there was the spin of omission when he did not identify that it was ultra-right people who had committed an act of violence, and just sort of shoved it into the cloud of the protest. In other words, the protests are the cause and effect of everything, rather than there's a whole huge network of causes and effects that have forced African Americans to take to the streets because they are having horrific violence visited upon them. And that people have not been trained to think, what argument, if someone's putting forth an opinion, what facts, what information are they buttressing this with? They just spew an idiotic opinion, and then that becomes the truth. So, you know, there are lots of distortions on, as well as false information. And I think that people aren't trained to think this way. They're not trained to think, what's a logical fallacy? Oh, okay, we just got a huge generalization there to the entire movement. From one example, for instance, and that becomes the whole thing. So, yeah, that's all I have to say, but thank you so much, and I'm so glad you both are on. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Karen. Appreciate the comment. I would say that's spot on. There's a whole ecosystem that allowed this current set of events to take shape, and it's actively still being reinforced at the very highest level. Last night on Fox News, President Trump aired an interview, or they aired an interview with President Trump on Laura Ingraham's show, in which he compared the shooting of Jacob Blake in the back seven times to someone choking and missing a putt in a golf tournament. Like, oh, you know, here's what he said. I'll just read the quote. Shooting a guy in the back many times, I mean, couldn't you have done something different? Couldn't you have wrestled him? In the meantime, he might have been going for a weapon. There's a whole big thing there, but they choke, he added, just like in a golf tournament. They miss a 3-foot putt. So, oh yeah, it's all good. This was just a mistake. He needs to work on his putting, this officer. This is astonishing. And I want to advise our listeners, as I often do, I want you to imagine any Democratic president and imagine those words coming out of his or her mouth. Imagine the uproar on the right. Imagine the heads exploding on Fox News. What's happening here is that not only is this violence being normalized, but this kind of extremist, insightful rhetoric is being normalized at the highest levels of American life. And if you don't think people don't take cues from what the president says and does, you are sorely mistaken. You need look no further than the young man Rittenhouse, who gunned down three people in cold blood in Wisconsin. What the president says matters. What he does matters. And what when people who follow him commit murder, we are in a seriously dangerous state of affairs.
Yeah, absolutely. And that level of minimizing a human life down to a 3-foot golf putt, it's not new for this person, right? This person spews things like this all the time, has said they could shoot people on, you know, the middle of downtown New York and nobody would do anything about it. And it's been mostly true, right? We're at 183,000 human lives in the United States taken by a very preventable pandemic, right? We're doing the worst in the world as a country, and we have some of the most innovative abilities to use science and knowledge to curb this, right? But we're doing nothing. And so we have to begin thinking about, in that ethos of minimizing lives, whose lives are we talking about, right? Because what it's coming down to is now that it's even the protesters who are in the way, right? And their lives don't matter. And so I think we've got to step back and say, yes, this person is absolutely dangerous. And we absolutely have to do something about that, right? We have to do whatever we can, and not trying to expose or share a political position. But it's dangerous. We know it. It's nothing new. The person says it is what it is when we talk about the number of people who have died from COVID-19, right? And we have to do something individually to say, no, this is not okay. This is not okay.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. There's a term out there that sociologists use. It's called stochastic terrorism. And that describes the phenomenon when someone in a position of power, in a position of high visibility, keeps continuously propagating messages of hate, of violence, and then eventually you start to see these acts of violence occur. And you can't connect the dots directly. Trump didn't say, hey, young man Rittenhouse, pick up your gun, go into Wisconsin and shoot some people. Of course he did not. But he certainly sowed the ground for these actions to happen. And it's not limited to this man in Wisconsin. We can look at incident after incident after incident in this country since he was elected. And of course, if we're being honest, throughout our country's history, this has been a phenomenon. This has been this pattern of stochastic terrorism, and the tacit endorsement of violence against people of color by the state has been a part of American life from the very beginning. And all I can say to my fellow white people right now is we should feel incredibly fortunate that black folks are only looking for justice and not for revenge. Let's go to the phones. George, good morning.
Good morning, Abe and Joe, and a very, very important topic, and I'll be try to be brief here.
Joe's not with us, so this morning we got Tracy on the horn today.
I looked at a book on my shelf by a man named Lennox Hinds, H-I-N-D-S, who was head of a group of black lawyers back in the 1970s, and he said the things that were happening then to black folks, the murders by police, and that was one thing, are not new then. They have been going on for decades. And I just wanted to mention that because I think somebody said this is a new event, and it is new, the recent things in Wisconsin and so on. But at the same time, like many new events, there are, and I think you just said this almost, that there are dynamics there that have been around for a long time. I think you already said that, didn't you?
We did, yes.
Well, I think my comments, I just wanted to mention this book called Illusions of Justice by Lennox S. Hinds, a professor at the time this book was published, and a leader of a black lawyers group. And the book was published in, I think, 1978. And I'll just get off the air because we already have so much on the plate here. Thank you so much.
Thanks, George.
Yeah, thanks very much, George. Let's go to Harriet. Good morning.
Oh, greetings, everyone, and thank you for taking my call. What's going on in the streets of Portland is the fight for democracy. Everyone in this country doesn't have the same democracy. And what's going on right now is exactly what happened 30 years ago in South Korea. The students took to the streets because their government was not a democratic government, and a lot of students were hurt. A lot of students, and quite a few of them died. What these students did was they put on helmets and they start fighting the police. And what happened? Eventually, the South Koreans were realizing they're killing our children. We must change, and so they did. And now South Korea is one of the best democracies in the world. Same thing happened with in Japan in 1991. The students took to the streets, and what was their complaint? Nuclear weapons on Japanese soil. And they fought on street violence. If you look at some of the things that were going on back then, and they were successful in changing the Japanese government of having nuclear weapons actually on Japanese soil. And the issue I have right now is our local news media. We're talking about the television, channel 2, 6, 8, and 12, is they're in collusion with each other. They're leaving out a lot of information. It's almost, now I know why everyone goes to onto the computer and to social media for information, because look what they have done. I mean, I watched Channel 6 trying to find out the person who had died, and they were kind of obscure on the story. It was very terrible. They didn't give any very information about what he did for a living. Did he have any children? It was really, it was really controlling. I mean, example, if you ever watched the news 2, 6, 8, 12, one's doing weather, turn the channel, the other one's doing weather. It's all, they're in collusion with each other, and the information they're giving is wrong. And what we're still trying to find out about this gentleman who had died, so far on the news, on the Twitter and Facebook, he was a provocateur. He was downtown spraying bear mace at people, and they knew who he was, and that's what was going on. They confronted him, and this is what happened. Don't get me wrong, it's tragic. No gun should have been going off, but after this, they arrested 27 demonstrators. Two of them had guns. So both sides have guns. Hopefully this will stop the violence that's going on. And also, the question I have for you is, a lot of the demonstrators, the Black Lives Matter, are they students? They seem to be younger. Your opinion on that?
Hey, thank you, Harry, for the call. Excellent comments, as always. Tracy, do you want to field that one?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they're necessarily students, but they are younger folks, younger than me, and I count myself as the oldest millennial. So they're millennials, Gen Zers. I think they live in a world that's very different from generations before me. That necessarily they live in pretty integrated places. They may have family members and interracial relationships and relatives who are of different backgrounds, races, ethnic
you know, descriptions, and so their lives are a little bit different than, say, a boomer or someone who's a little bit older who actually existed in the time of segregation and went through that struggle of that era of revolution. So these are mostly younger people, not super young. I have not been in the streets protesting like I have in the past, because I am the oldest millennial, and I think I've just left that work for other people who are coming behind me. But I have a daughter who's a TikToker who was part of, you know, ordering up a whole bunch of stuff on the Trump website and putting it in the basket and not buying it. So I think the young folks have it. We need to step back. For me, I've stepped aside to allow them to show up in the world and their activism and to support it. Of course, I'm not a big supporter of burning things or you know, destroying things, but I also know that in some ways that is what gets the ire and gets the attention. I also want to kind of lean into what you said, Harry, about, you know, this happened and then more people were arrested, as if arresting more people is the solution. Or adding more police to a system of police brutality that has befallen a certain demographic, of course, Black people, is the solution. At some point, we're going to have to step back from that and say, okay, is more police just adding fuel to the fire? Or are we going to hear the demands of these protesters and what they want to create systemic change?
Yeah. Well, according to Governor Kate Brown, more police, that probably is part of the solution, according to the governor. We'll get to that in just a moment. But I want to piggyback on some of the things you said there. You're right about millennials. In poll after poll, the younger generation is incredibly progressive. On issue after issue, the environment, on issues of gender, on issues of race, on issues of financial inequality, over and over and over again. And I would add to that that consider the lifespan of your typical millennial. Like somebody, say, born in the mid to late 90s, right? The United States has been at war for most of that young person's life. In the course of that young person's life, they have seen now two major global financial collapses, separated by not that many years, and are also now looking at living through a global pandemic. They are the first generation in American history to expect to not do as well materially as the generations that came before. So they're looking at, they are the disinherited generation, for lack of a better term. So I look at what's going on, and we can look at the attempts to set fire to the door of the Justice Center or to, to light fires to cars outside of the North Precinct. All these things in a vacuum are deplorable, but in context, they're entirely understandable. Now, I'm not condoning violence. I'm not condoning arson. None of those things am I condoning. But at the same time, you can empathize. One can understand that sort of anger and the desire to watch it all burn. I entirely sympathize with that sentiment. But that having been said, I think we on the progressive side of this equation need to do a better job of reining in those people who are all too willing to use violence and the destruction of property as tools of their expression. It makes it too easy for the other side to demonize us. And they're already willing to demonize us, as we've seen time and time again. And one more comment about Harry's call, which was really provocative. I appreciate that call, Harry. He talked about the transitions in both South Korea and Japan, and how peaceful demonstrations and expressions of the public will were sufficient to affect dramatic change in both of those countries. That is true. And while stating immediately that I'm not an expert in either Japanese or South Korean history, I think it's fair to say that there was not a similar element of racial disparity in those cultures to that which we experience here in the United States. That is the factor, I think, that is elevating the tension in this situation, and which makes it so easy for people on the white supremacist side to utilize violence, because that has always been part of the equation here. So, everyone call Harry. Let's go to Jean-Pierre, and then we can talk about Kay Brown and the Republican National Convention. Good morning, Jean-Pierre.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, how are you?
I'm doing great. I wanted to submit kind of a theory and idea for your reflection and get your response. It's tracing this election cycle, and this is kind of a diversion from the previous topic, but along this, you know, related to the underlining themes. But, you know, tracing the course of this election cycle and the poll and the polling and the positions of Donald Trump and Joe Biden on the issues, you know, it appeared at the beginning that it might be a close race. And when I'm saying when Joe Biden was the presumptive nominee after, you know, Super Tuesday, but then the coronavirus set in and Joe Biden stepped out to an early lead and has maintained that lead throughout the summer. It's a sizable lead between, you know, whatever you want to call it, 8% and 12%. And
I think he had that lead even before the coronavirus epidemic. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I stand corrected then.
No, please.
But the point is that now recent polls, and I take these polls often with a grain of salt because they're fickle, and recent elections have established that polling data is not always very reliable. But there is a trend now that, at least in the last couple of days, that that lead is whittling down to a 4 or 6%, or even in some polls I've seen less than that. And what that leads me to ask is, or to put forth as a food for thought, is a lot of people, and it seems like the strategy was by the Democratic Party, is to make this a referendum on Donald Trump. And at first, I believe that may have been a successful strategy, because Biden seemed to be winning without discussing much about the issues or speaking frequently on these issues. But I think that's a serious misstep here, because if you can recall, there are many people who said, you know, when that Access Hollywood tape came out, that this is the end of Donald Trump's presidential campaign. And we stand here now 4 years later, and I cannot count the number of, you know, scandals, exposés, you know, gaffes by Donald Trump, and his approval rating has stayed relatively consistent. I think the polling on Donald Trump's character is done. It's not going to change. And what the Democratic Party has not done, and what Joe Biden has not done, I think, very successfully, is make this a campaign about the issues. And I think that's very important, because as you've seen in this Republican National Convention, it doesn't really matter what the facts are to his base. What does matter is that he speaks to their anger and he validates their fear. And unless there's some discussion about these issues in substance from the opposing campaign, those people are going to vote that way. And I'm not saying that Biden is going to chuck away or hack away at his base. I'm talking about the people who would maybe just be inclined to bite the bullet, vote for someone who's unsavory in all other aspects, because they feel like they have somebody who's confident in charge and speaks to their anger and their fear. And that's dangerous. That's very dangerous. I think that the Democrats have a number of ways that they can attack this and to flip the script by saying, if you want to talk about law and order, let's talk about law and order, and let's talk about a country that respects the right to assemble to engage in free speech, and that doesn't have people picked up off the street without judicial proceedings. That's kind of my rant and my thought, but I'd like to appreciate your opinion on these issues. I'll take my answer off the air.
Hey, thank you for the call, Jean-Pierre. Chris, do you have anything to say about that?
I mean, that was a lot. What I will say is that polls are absolutely unreliable. I am, 40 years old, and I have never been polled for anything. One, I don't answer phone calls that aren't from people I know, so I'm a huge screener. And I don't have a plugged-in landline. So anytime you think about polls, you have to think about who answers the phone for people who they don't know, and who has landlines. Because I'm guessing that's the number of people who are going to be polled, those people. And so you're thinking older folks, maybe folks who are just more likely to respond. So I've actually polled, right, with my own lens, polled my own friends to say, have any of y'all ever been invited to be part of a poll? And they've all said no, and I have lots of friends. So I will just say that polls are not reliable, and polls oftentimes are a way of suppressing the vote. By saying, oh, the polling shows that, X, Y, and Z is going to win, right? So then people are like, well, I don't need to vote because X, Y, and Z is going to win. So I, as a rule, I just encourage people to ignore that fully and show up and vote. I also want to say in the situation that happened in 2016, there were lots of other elements, right? There was the October surprise, but her emails and all of that rhetoric that also diminished the impact of the Access Hollywood tape. And for the record, many people who were planning to vote for Donald Trump knew full well who he was. So
didn't care.
They still voted and supported that. And then there was also the international help that was provided to Donald Trump that we don't still know all of the details about. So I want to just hold that for a moment and say that right now we have a situation where the DNI, Director of National Intelligence, has said that they are no longer going to be providing live hearings about election interference. And so it is not really for me an issue about protesting or showing up in the streets, but it is an issue about how the Democratic campaign expressed the need and ability to vote as a critical issue of our time. When we think about the legacy of John Lewis and others who really put their lives on the line to protect voting rights for all people, we're in that moment where we know in Oregon, because of the Electoral College, our votes are not going to count the same way that they'll count in Wisconsin or somewhere else that is seen as a battleground state, whether Florida or Arizona. And that doesn't really make a whole bunch of sense. So at some point, we're going to have to address the vestiges that are embedded in the Electoral College that say mm-hmm. that some people don't have the same balance in their vote as others. We are going to have to address things like voter suppression and gerrymandering. And unfortunately, to talk about these issues to the people who are literally paralyzed by fear because of the rhetoric of the right wing and Donald Trump, they don't really care about those issues. So the issues that are going to matter to people who really are progressive and really want to move the nation forward, when we think about the extreme left and their reluctance to really buy into Joe Biden as their candidate but are willing to vote for him, those people are going to have to be, pushed in some ways. And then those people who are in the middle. Right now, I feel like if you are an undecided voter, I would love a chance to talk with you because I don't understand how you could be undecided at this
right?
point. Who do you need more information about, right? What more information do you need? But I do think, within that kind of polling and understanding the validity of polling, we have to just throw that out completely and do what we can to show up and vote on November 3rd.
Yeah, absolutely right. Jean-Pierre, I thought, was spot on when he noted that there seems to be a block of the electorate that is irreducibly ride or die for Trump. right? They don't care. They'll swear up and down on their Christianity and their patriotism, but they, you know, they don't mind the Access Hollywood tape. They don't mind any of it. And that shows us the extent to which political identity is tribal in our society. They don't care as long as he stays in power. So in that context, you can view this period of time, and most especially this election, as the last ditch holding action of white supremacy to maintain its hold on social, political, and economic life in the United States. I'm not saying with Donald Trump's defeat in November, it will be the end of white supremacy, but I think it will be a critical nail in that coffin, to use a much overused metaphor. So you're absolutely right. We really have to hold the line. We have to turn out and vote. We have to reach out to undecided voters, wherever or whoever they might be. And it's absolutely imperative. You cannot be neutral at this point in time in the United States of America. If you are, I really don't know what to say about that. It's just baffling to me. Yes. So let's, for a moment, switch over to what's happening here in Oregon. We mentioned a few minutes ago that our governor, Kate Brown, has come up with a new, what is being called a unified law enforcement plan to protect free speech and bring violence and arson to an end in Portland. Those are ominous words. The governor is calling for more policing. She wants to draw in state police to the Portland area. She wants to draw in sheriff's deputies from Washington and Clackamas counties to help out in Portland. All of this to free up the resources of the Portland Police Bureau to conduct investigations into actual crimes that may have been committed. I appreciate the governor's sentiment, and I appreciate this especially. I want to read to you from her statement here. The right-wing group Patriot Prayer and self-proclaimed militia members drove into downtown Portland last night, armed and looking for a fight. Every Oregonian has the right to freely express their views without fear of deadly violence. I will not allow Patriot Prayer and armed white supremacists to bring more bloodshed to our streets. I want to stop right here and give credit where it's due. This is the governor of our state calling out white supremacy as the enemy. That is no small thing. That is incredibly important, and I'm grateful that she did that. However, I don't think bringing in more cops is the answer to what's happening night after night here in Portland. Perhaps a firm commitment to defund the police and come up with a better way to address the emergencies that arise in everyday people's lives besides sending the guys with guns and badges all the time. That's the sort of commitment that we need. So yeah, you get an A for effort, Governor Brown, but I'm a little bit worried about your prescription here.
Absolutely, absolutely. We don't, stop a fire by putting more wood on it, right?
Right.
It doesn't really make a ton of sense. And so, you know, at some point there will have to be systemic solutions put forth to create a sense in the protesters that there's no need to protest anymore, right? But as long as we try to patch and say, oh, no, we're not going to defund, and I just want to lean into the word defund for a moment. We've been mm-hmm. defunding public education. We've been defunding public mm-hmm. health. We've been defunding all of the things that would require us not to need so many police over time, and not really addressing the source, right? Mass incarceration does not help the public health sector. Mass incarceration does not do anything to support our education system. We really have to turn our eye and shift our gaze to what would help, what would create a need for less police, if that's social services, whether that's healthcare services. We know mental health is a huge challenge in the Portland yeah. metro area with regard to our homeless population. So if we're not going to lean into really creating systemic solutions, we are going to continue to see night 100, night 200 of protests because we haven't addressed the real issues that people are even protesting about.
I agree. At some point, you have to wonder, has this turned into just a nightly skirmish now based upon people's residual anger from the night before? The message eventually gets diffused and muddied in this situation. You're absolutely correct. Let's go to the phones. Frank, good morning.
Good morning. Got a quick comment on this Kenosha shooting for you. The New York Times published a piece, which was the truth, with all the camera video that went on. This 17-year-old was shot at first, chased down the block, tripped, got smacked in the back of the head with a skateboard, and he defended himself. And then, for whatever reason, I 17-year-old scared, went back to his own state and then turned himself in. So let's put the record straight here instead of propagating this leftist propaganda about, these militia guys. No, that's not the case. That is not the case.
He went to a peaceful protest with a rifle and shot three people. I don't understand what part of that narrative we're getting wrong.
How do you say it's a peaceful protest when these people are burning establishments down, breaking into cars, burning cars, taking I watched the video that night, Tuesday night, on TV, where they're taking Dipsy dumpsters, lighting them on fire in front of a gas station, no less. These aren't peaceful people. These are not. These are anarchists. These are Marxists, and they got an agenda. And these governors and these mayors.
We seem to have lost Frank. Well, that's unfortunate because Frank was wrong. You can't equate damage to property with damage to human life. That is a false equivalent. And I see that come up time and time and time again. Well, if they didn't want to get beat on by the police, well, maybe they shouldn't have set a fire in that trash can. Those are not, that is a false equivalent. And that, it really gets to the nut of this problem, I think. Somehow it has become acceptable for state violence to be inflicted upon the bodies of citizens if sufficient grounds are adjudged to be found. And that is just false on its face. And when you consider the context, of course, which is black and brown bodies are bearing the brunt of state violence and have for centuries, no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Frank. That argument just does not hold water for me.
Yeah, and even to the point of, what are the real facts? Well, it'll take a while for those real facts to come out. We are having commentary on what we know is true, right? This person shot three people. So getting into whether he was beaten up or not. But also, in my opinion, it's not appropriate to take a gun to a fist fight, right? Like, you are mm-hmm. escalating at a different level when you retaliate. And it becomes not necessarily self-defense if you came with a gun in the first place, right? And there's crossing state lines with this rifle and you're 17 and not legally able to carry that kind of firepower. There's the issue of the mom delivering him to the next state to protect buildings. And I also want to talk about kind of what we believe to be the ethos of America is human rights, human values, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, where we really have been set up as a property and owner class society, right? And so even those of us who may not even own property, who may have nothing to do with that property, have been really indoctrinated into a system that values property and money and capitalist values over human life. I just want to say that because there's no equivalency between burning a trash can, putting some stuff on fire, burning a door, and shooting a person seven times in the back to paralyze him, or sitting on someone's neck for 8 minutes and 42 seconds. So,
it's kind of like missing a 3-foot putt. It's kind of like missing a 3-foot putt, right? Susan writes in to say, and if you would like to drop us a written line, you could do so, facebook.com/AbeandJoe. She writes, defunding the police is a provocation to the other side. Perhaps best to say redistribution of public safety resources. I think Susan is on to something here. I think defund the police is not a very good slogan. Anytime you have a slogan where you say defund the police, and then you have to follow it with by which I mean A, B, C, D, and E, that's not a very good slogan. I think she's right. I think we can come up with a better way to succinctly express, yes, the redistribution of public safety resources. That's a better way to say it. It doesn't roll off the tongue quite the same way, though. All right, we are drawing near the end here. Tracy, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Absolutely, and I think we're going to have you back next week.
Oh, wait, yay, awesome.
We had intended today to talk about the Republican National Convention, which was its own special cavalcade of horrors, amply doused with cocaine, I'm willing to speculate, on a couple of occasions.
I don't know.
Adderall. Yeah, that's probably it. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. So maybe next week we can touch on that a little bit. There's just so much to talk about these days, and we're grateful to have your support, listeners. And I need to add before we sign off, that it's not just this program that needs your support. It is this station. We need the voice like KBOO on the news media now more than we ever have before. So log on to KBOO.fm, click on the donate button, and become a member of KBOO. Anything you'd like to say, Tracy, before we sign off here?
I would just say, you know, in gratitude to all of our listeners, please take care of yourselves and others. And I hope to chat soon.
All right. This has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program with special guest host Tracy Simmons. I want to thank, as always, everybody who called up and made comments. You keep this show honest, and you keep us all on our toes and moving forward. And we appreciate your contributions, not just to this dialogue, but to all issues that affect our community. This has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program, and we will be back at you next week.
This is KBOO Portland. That was the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program with special guest host Tracy Simmons. For folks who are curious about Ms. Simmons and her credentials, her name is spelled T-R-A-C-I-S-I-M.